brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Welcome to Results Matter Radio. I am Lee Cantor, and no Elizabeth, but I do have Miss Dana Barrett. How are you doing, Dana?
I am doing well. Thank you for asking.
Exciting show today. Women in leadership. That's a role that you hold. You're a woman in leadership.
I am a woman who likes to boss people around. I don't know if that's the same thing, but there you go.
Close enough. We got a great group today. We got Katie Caperton. She's the editor-in-chief of HLN Digital. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you.
And we got Maggie... I knew I was going to mess it up. Garrity.
Garrity, that's right. Yeah,
I knew I was messed. Sorry. And she's the director of marketing and operations at Thomas Arvid Fine Art. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you.
And we got a good friend, sponsor of the show, Ashby Kent with Burn Foreman. Welcome, Ashby.
Hi, Lee. Hi, Dana.
Hello.
Welcome, Katie and Maggie.
Now, I'd like to lead off a little bit, just get a little background information from Maggie and Katie. Maggie, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about your work at Arvid.
Well, I represent Thomas Arvid. He's an artist who is a photorealist style painter that paints wine. For him, I handle all of his production operations and also all of his marketing strategies. And I work with numerous wineries and museums and galleries across the country.
Cool. And Katie, a little bit about what you do every day?
Yeah. What I do every day. Let's see.
It changes, right?
It does. So I work for HLN, which is the sister network to CNN, and I oversee the editorial for HLN Digital. So if you go to hlntv.com on your desktop, mobile, tablet, wherever, I oversee all the editorial for their sites. So working really closely with our on-air partners, Nancy Grace, Dr. Drew, those folks, and yeah, just sort of put together the website every day.
And Ashby, what about you?
I am a partner in Burr & Foreman's Atlanta office. I specialize in business commercial litigation. And actually, I'm here today to talk a little bit about an exciting initiative at our firm, which is the women's initiative that our firm has just started last year. It kind of the groundswell began. So exciting things are going on in my firm in terms of promoting women in leadership roles, both in the firm aspect, law firm, which is what I do, of course, and then also in our community in Atlanta.
Dana, any thoughts on women in leadership that we should know about?
Women in leadership rock. I'm so helpful this morning, aren't I? I haven't had enough coffee, but, you know, I think it's great to see this. It's kind of funny that you're in here, Lee. I think we should really kick you out of the room. But I think it's so I think growing up for me, this was not the case. You know, when you looked at leadership positions, you did not see a lot of women sitting at the table. And I think it's amazing that we are here now. And I think it's amazing for the girls growing up now to see it. And I mean, I know my daughter who's in college doesn't even blink an eye about what her options are. So I'm glad to have you all here.
Now, Katie, I'd like to know a little bit about kind of your path of how you got to where you are.
Yeah. So I grew up here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And when I was deciding where to go to college, I knew I wanted to live in New York City. So I went to NYU. I was there for all 4 years, did journalism. Graduated, started working for a trade magazine. So every industry has a trade magazine,
sure,
including the magazine industry. So I was a writer for the trade magazine for the magazine industry. I thought it would be very glamorous and ended up being very boring. I was writing about paper prices and had no idea what I was talking about. So I did that for about a year. It was a lot of fun, though. I got to meet a lot of people who worked in the magazine industry in New York and make a lot of really great contacts, which ultimately got me to my next position, which was a very big change, but I was working for Star Magazine, the celebrity tabloid in New York.
Yeah.
The reason I went there is the woman who relaunched Us Weekly was hired away from Us Weekly to go to Star Magazine and to relaunch all of their titles. So she's just sort of the godmother of tabloid media. Uh-huh. And Celebrity Weekly. Sorry, I think she would not like
tabloid.
That title. But no, Bonnie Fuller is her name, and she's just a huge, huge person in the industry. So when she started working at Star, I was like, I'll do anything. So I basically did anything. I worked crazy hours, and I had a great time there. I worked there for a couple of years. And moved up from copy editor to assistant managing editor. And then in 2004, I believe, when OK Magazine was launching in the U.S., from the UK. They were looking to bring on a team, so they hired me as the launch managing editor. I was managing editor, executive editor, and eventually editor-in-chief. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. So my background is in celebrity news. And then I moved to Atlanta, moved back to Atlanta a couple years ago to work with CNN Digital to sort of help them kind of sort of amp up their entertainment coverage on CNN.com, CNN Mobile. And then about a year ago, HLN hired me sort of within the building to come on and launch their digital product.
Now, is it different working in digital as it is in print?
Yeah, it's great. Actually, it's the future. Who knew? It's awesome.
But it's fast. I mean, it never ends. Like in print, you have to go to print at some point.
Yeah, that was very stressful. Like you send this thing to the press, you're like, I hope there's no mistakes in it. But it's great because not only is it sort of a living, breathing, constantly moving sort of platform, you actually have interaction with the audience all the time.
Right.
So
it's more of a dialogue.
Yeah, constantly. You see what they like. You see what they don't like. They tell you when they don't like it. Here's a really small example, one that I love. You go onto websites and you can comment on stories. I hate this. You're right. Terrible. The commenting system on HLNTV.com is done through Facebook. So you actually are commenting with your own kind of Facebook account. You have to go on the site and see what it looks like. It's pretty cool. And I hop in there all the time. And people just don't think that like the editor of the site is going to have this conversation with them. But if people find us, we had a story yesterday about, iPad is not your babysitter. So we had this writer do a piece. It's like, you know what? I'm not going to stick an iPad in front of my kids. That's it. I'm sick of this. So just great debate back and forth in the comments. So I jumped in there and started having this conversation with them. And I just really, it's an interesting platform to be involved in because it's just this constant dialogue with the audience. And it teaches you a lot about how to approach storytelling, how to approach story curation, and what your own sort of opinions are and what the audience feels about that. So I absolutely love it. And, I will probably
say you've made the transition from print to digital. It wasn't that big of a leap for you because some of the media properties are having a harder time.
I think you just lie. I think you just tell them that you know what you're doing and you don't.
Go
and you show
forward,
up and
right?
You buy a book and you read it and you hope
that,
Yeah, it was a big transition for me, but I think I probably did lie a lot in whatever meetings I had to get over to CNN. Luckily, they bought it. It was a transition and I figured out, there's the technicals and then there's like wrapping your head around sort of this different platform that you have a million more opportunities with.
Right.
So it was transition, but I'm really, really glad that I've landed on the side and thrilled to be working with CNN and HLN and back in Atlanta. What turned into such a great organization. I can't even say enough nice things about it. And especially in this dialogue of women in leadership roles.
Are there a lot of women in leadership roles there?
Yeah. I was sitting in a meeting, which is like a, meeting of sort of higher level editors across HLN and the head of the network, Scott Safon. He looked around the table the other day and he remarked, he's like, this is pretty much all women in here. And I think, for me, it's my experience has always been that, especially working in media more on the creative side, there really hasn't been much of an issue with sort of moving up and being a female. And I've always had really strong, supportive female leaders around me in every sort of step that I've made in my career. So it really, it's pretty remarkable. I think someone coming in from, a different field, marketing or legal or finance would probably look at a meeting at HLN or CNN and think, wow, this is fascinating that this is predominantly female. It's sitting literally at the table making big decisions for the network.
Are most of the consumers of HLN digital women?
Yep. We on air and on digital, we do skew more heavily female.
Now, Ashby, has that been your experience in the legal field?
Well, what's interesting is I think the legal field has been, and I grew up in a family. My father was a lawyer. My mother was a legal secretary. So you can kind of see the framework.
So you didn't want to be a legal secretary?
Exactly. You can see the framework of where I came from was this idea of women are the lawyer, or men are the lawyers and women are the assistants.
Right.
And that's not just law-based. I think that was,
right,
as Dana pointed out, that's certainly not, that was kind of the social construct even in the generation of our parents. And we've seen a dramatic shift both in applicants to law school and female attorneys in terms of the number of women that are going into law. The problem that we see now is, although we're seeing a dramatic increase in the number of female law school applicants and the number of female attorneys, I think where we tend to drop off are women that stay in private practice and obtain leadership roles in the partnership track.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, numerous issues play into that, but obviously the demands of a legal career, especially in private practice, are very difficult to balance with having a family and doing other things outside of just billing hours and, right. you know, being accessible 24/7. And so what my firm is really trying to do, and as Katie pointed out, you know, we're very fortunate at Burr, I think, to have a strong contingent of women leadership in equity partner and partner roles. And their goal with, especially with the Women's Initiative, and this is led from the top down, this isn't something that that younger associates or staff are really behind. This is really from the top down. Our top female equity partners are really making an effort to try and look at the retention problems that we have with female attorneys. How can we get female attorneys not only to apply to law school, not only to get jobs at firms, how can we get them to stay on the partnership track or to continue to succeed in higher level leadership in law? And I think that's really where we're trying to focus is keeping women around and making sure that women have the support that they need to achieve those higher roles in leadership in law.
Now, Maggie, can you talk a little bit about your path?
Absolutely. I actually went to school at George Washington in D.C., and that's where I fell in love with art. I fell in love with the idea that it's open to everyone, and just being able to live amongst it was something that just spoke to me. So I actually came back to school here as well at Georgia State, and for my second degree. And at the time, I think most women were kind of in art, pushed towards going in art history or pursuing a field that's either in museum studies, something that's curatorial. But for me, I really like to be out among people, and that didn't speak with me. So with doing a little research in my alumni association, I found an artist who had a self-publishing company, which in our industry, that's very rare. A lot of times when you're a published artist and you have limited editions, it's through a larger corporate entity. And Vanessa Arvid, who is his wife, actually owned the company, and she's the person who had the idea to go ahead and self-publish Thomas. So when I came across them, I thought that really fit for me because it's more business-oriented and social. You know, honestly, there are so few in the commercial world who are able to get a degree in art and still work in art. So I think among the people that I know who I went to school with, both in D.C. and in Georgia, there's two other people I know who even work in art. So it's definitely an open field. And I think especially for a lot of young female artists, right now there's kind of a surge that you see a lot of large publishing companies that are primarily male-dominated. But you're starting to see young female artists who are, you know, coming out of that. And I think in terms of leadership, what I would kind of say to them is to look towards the idea of self-publishing and having your own business. I think in the world of art, it's really difficult to break through unless you kind of go that route.
So, and where you work, the guy is the artist and the wife is the business person?
That's right. She's the president of our company. So actually the top two executives in our company are myself and Vanessa Arvid, which is great. And of course, Thomas Arvid is the artist and the painter. And everything that we do is very artist driven. But we handle all of his marketing strategy and the accounts and sales to galleries across the country. And we actually I was just the director of exhibition and sponsorships for his first museum exhibition, which was here in Marietta at the Marietta Cobb Museum of Art. So that was a great experience. And it's definitely a rare transition that you see an artist as contemporary artists having museum exhibition at the same time that they're able to commercially sell their artwork to galleries. So that's certainly something that I've been excited about this week.
Now, why don't you talk a little bit about his art, because it's kind of unusual. He's an artist that works solely with wine as the backdrop or primarily?
Yes, that's the focus of his subject. He paints wine it's a photorealist style, but his focus is more on telling the story of the consumption and the sort of the beauty of wine. So that when you look at the paintings, they're all oil on canvas or generally oil mediums. What you kind of see is the reflections in the bottle, and it's usually kind of from either a worm's eye or a bird's eye perspective, and you can kind of see part of the scene that's taking place. So it's more about capturing that moment and, you know, seeing the special memory than it is about just having a still life of just wine with, you know, kind of think about the old traditional style that you saw in Europe where it's like, it's a tablecloth with cheese and wine and, you know, kind of not that engaging. But in Thomas's pieces, it's so detailed, and being able to kind of draw closer in and look at the glass and see like a window in the reflection or try to guess at what the place it is, that is more what his work is about. And I think for people relating to it, a lot of times people have, you know, special moments. You know, you bought a great bottle and you had an anniversary, or you had, you know, a huge party with friends and one huge wine night. And so a lot of the relation to his work, I think, is about remembering those stories and kind of capturing that moment.
You should do with marketing.
What do you know? Qualified. And I have this lovely piece here.
Are you using online to market?
Absolutely. We actually are launching a new website this week, so we've just redesigned it. But you know, with having a blog, I think readers are able to see a little bit more insight into Thomas's lifestyle, because you know, so much of you know working in the wine industry and in the art industry is about the lifestyle. You know, people purchase artwork if they you know can relate to it, if it's something that really speaks to them. And I would especially say that you know women are the primary decision makers in the home. So let me tell you, when someone walks into the gallery, he is not buying that piece of artwork unless his wife is like, okay, yes, I'll take it. So, you know, I do find that having that sentimentality and being able to reach out to them to tell the story
right,
is very
helpful. Connect emotionally.
Absolutely. Right. So the website is key for that.
How much of that is video nowadays? Because I know, I mean, that's really a question for both of you, because obviously when all this internet interwebby stuff started, it was words and pictures, and now so much of it is media like this, you know, like radio and video and things like that. Do you find that that's like absolutely critical component for what you're doing at this point, or is it something you're leaning more towards, or where does that fit in?
For us, yeah, absolutely. Especially because we come from, you know, we're the website for a fully distributed cable news network.
Of course.
So for us, it's huge. People want to go back and see the clips from their favorite shows. I think, you know, it's funny. People with, you know, this is sort of a different conversation, but people are kind of funny with video online. Sometimes you want to watch it and sometimes you don't. So
right.
You kind of have to find the most engaging videos to get people to kind of click through that. So it's a huge part of the business. Definitely from a business standpoint, you want to sort of have more video and have more just more things that people can kind of play around with on the site. It helps people stay on the site a little bit longer and helps their kind of engagement time. And it just also, it's a better experience.
Is that the metric you look at, is time on the site?
We look at lots of metrics. Time on the site, how many clicks per person.
How many times they go back.
How many times they go back. You know, how many unique visitors you have. So you could have one person who goes and clicks all day long, which is great. You also want more people clicking all day long. So, you know, my mom probably clicks on the site a million times a day. Thanks, Mom. But, you know, you also want like more people also clicking and staying for a long time and being engaged in your content because it shows the community that, you know, people just aren't kind of coming to your site looking and leaving. They're actually engaged and talking and responding. And you like to see them coming from social media sites as well. So again, we talked about Facebook earlier. Facebook is and Twitter and Pinterest and all these other sharing sites, it's a really great kind of front door for you because it, you know, people, I think, you know, just as a consumer, I'm more likely to click on a story if a friend of mine has posted it on Facebook. There's some sort of like...
Right, like they've already vetted
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like they have validated the story for
right.
me. They vetted it. They like it. So
I'll have more, to remember that.
More and more, I think people are looking at their own newsfeed, be it Twitter or Facebook or Google Reader, however they're kind of pulling together their own newsfeed as their own sort of personalized homepage every day. So you could go to a CNN.com. You can go to nhlntv.com for sure. I think lots of people are now incorporating their own news feed as their kind of homepage for the entire internet.
Right. So they're like cobbling together their
yeah.
own personal kind
yeah.
of news feed that has what they're interested in.
So that's a big filter for a lot of the content is, you know, is this something that you would want to share on Facebook or Twitter?
Right.
Is that because it's breaking news? Is that because it's the headline is just so clever? It would be the status update that someone would want to write themselves. Is it a great photo that's attached to it? Is it a photo that would be pinned on Pinterest? So, you know, you, in addition to sort of, you now have this layer of disaggregation now when you're creating content of like, okay, it's great to create this wonderful content, but I actually have to work really hard to get it into everybody's feeds. So there's a lot of different things that go into why someone would share a story, but that's just another filter of the creation process too.
But now in your case, you're also having a filter of you have to promote the CNN stable of contributors too, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because on the HLN side, our content is just, it's so clickable. It's so shareable. I mean, Nancy Grace is, you know, she's just some of the things she says. I mean, you cannot look away. She is really engaging and just fun to watch. Really nice person. So, you know, we're really lucky in the sense that the content that's coming from our on-air partners, coming from Morning Express with Robin Mead, that's just super shareable anyway. So for us, it's actually, you know, it's great to have these on-air partners who are also doing that work for us and going and finding that really social, shareable, kind of talk-worthy content and creating video content around that.
But aren't you aggregating things outside of the CNN universe?
Yeah, absolutely. We work with a lot of partners. We work closely with a lot of partners. Cafe Mom is a big partner of ours. BuzzFeed, we work really closely with them. Mother Nature Network. So we try and find partners that, you know, that are doing really cool things, who are reaching out to audiences that we would like to talk to. But also we're constantly just sort of looking around and just trying to aggregate content that we just think is cool. When I was on the CNN side, I was overseeing their entertainment news, and we have this a blog on the entertainment section, and we created this sort of daily franchise that went out at like 4:30 every day. And I always wanted to call it like happy hour links, but that didn't work. It was we ended up calling it something like while you were working. So while you were doing like real work at your offices, we were reading every single celebrity blog
Somebody
out there.
Somebody has to do that.
Here are the 10 stories that you probably missed because you, again, were doing real work, right. And we do not. So here is your daily kind of offering of the best celebrity gossip of the day. So yeah, you know, you also, even though you want to bring people to your site, you want to make sure that you the audience knows that you're aware of the competitive landscape and you know what's going on, and you are constantly plugged into everything. So
you're okay with that if they go, as long as they're using you as that kind of central hub, you're okay with them.
You know, and the part of the whole thing is you want to be like a good web citizen too. You want to link out to other people and you hope that they want to link out to you. So if BuzzFeed notices that I've sent them a bunch of links one day, that's great, because now we have a great relationship anyway. But they also see that I am acknowledging their great work. We're sending folks over there. And, you know, it's just a good thing to sort of, you know, in the web community, to have great relationships with other sites and other editors. You want to be able to sort of link to folks and send them around.
It can't be like you're protective of your stuff. You have to be a good sharer.
Yeah. And you want to keep doing that. It's a nice thing to do.
Now, Maggie, how do you guys build community?
Well, you know, through the website, a lot of what we focus on is telling the story, because now, you know, Michelangelo had it easy. Back in the day, all you had to do is fall in love with the artwork. Now you have to fall in love with the artist. You know, you have to like, you know, what his style is, you know, where he lives, what he thinks. And so fortunately with Thomas, it's really easy. He's very personable. He loves to cook. He loves wine. You know, those are all aspects that make him very appealing to a lot of people. So, you know, a lot of focus on getting little video clips for him.
Like,
you know,
I noticed on your blog, you had a shrimp burger recipe.
Recipe, yes.
Now, I thought that was kind of interesting that an artist would be sharing a shrimp burger. Number one, I'd never heard of a shrimp burger, so I was curious from that standpoint. But do you have to really get to know him kind of to like him personally? That helps in the sale, I would think.
And, you know, for Thomas, a lot of what he does as well is travel to different galleries across the country having shows. So, you know, when he travels and people meet him, they really relate and they say, oh, you're coming to my city. And when he's there, he really tries to immerse. You know, we really try to do, you know, everything. Like, for instance, the shrimp burger was down in Low Country outside of South Carolina. So, you know, not only is Thomas going to the gallery show there, but he's, you know, getting the recipes and entertaining. And generally, you know, we'll rent a house, and instead of going to a hotel and then going out to see people, he'll bring people in. And, you know, we do a whole big wine dinner and entertaining and really get collectors involved. And so then when people hear that story in other locations, they want to know exactly what you did. So, you know, that's really helpful for the blog and for the website and being able to share, you know, a lot of his life, and that connects people to the artwork.
Now, is your audience collectors and also vineyards?
Yeah, actually, about 80% of our collectors are private collectors. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other 20% fall between restaurants and wineries. Some wineries will commission artwork with Thomas. But, you know, for most people, it's just, you know, it's having that special bottle to them that they really want to have in their cellar or in their home.
So having that label on their wall because it was from a meaningful event?
Could be the label. I think a lot of times it's almost the way, you know, a lot of times with his artwork, it's the way that the bottles and the glasses kind of interact. It's sort of, you know, the lighting brings that mood back. So I think it's almost more mood than it is really the
label
that people
connect.
So it
conjures up some emotional kind of memory that they relate to and they want to kind of capture
on canvas.
I have a question about kind of your field, because it's so specific in a way what you're doing. Is there a network of people like you, other women or women and men that are sort of doing promoting of artists?
There are. In the world of art, the best way that we sort of network with each other, there's large expositions like Art Expo New York is quite large. They just had one in Chicago. So that's kind of a bigger way that publishing companies can connect. So there are other women. Crown Thorn, for instance, they're a large publishing company, and they have a female executive there as well. But for the most part, it's also connecting through galleries. So a lot of what I do is also work with small businesses. So there are several of the galleries that are female-driven, and that's who we connect with kind of on a daily basis. And then, larger and peer network, it would be through the expositions.
Okay. Because, yeah, I sort of see you in this little, artist world by yourself. And I was worried.
What will happen?
I was feeling bad for you.
Well, it's funny because, given Thomas's subject matter, of course, I work equally as much in the world of wine as I do in the world of art. So that in itself is a little bit unique.
But so stop worrying about you. Yes.
Really? You're like, but, actually we have a staff of 10. So our publishing company is quite substantial for one artist, since we just represent his artwork. Most other publishing companies represent, 10, 20 artists. So, yes, don't worry. I talk to plenty of people all the time.
Now, when you're going about, can you take us through the process? Like, he develops a piece of art and then you have to market it, or you're doing marketing constantly and he's constantly creating art? Like, how does that happen?
His paintings are quite large. His largest piece is 96 inches across and about 3 feet high. So that's a pretty big piece. So for Thomas, it takes him a couple months to get one finished. So about 6 full oils a year, and he works on several smaller mediums in between. The largest part of our business is a limited edition program, which means that he, has one original, and then he has a very small edition size, sometimes about 300 pieces that are created. There's Giclée on canvas, which is a high-end print, and that's what supports the business. That's what is able to support him as a working artist. And so I sell that artwork out to galleries and also market that to both the public and to, our gallery clients. And that's what keeps his business going, because with only being able to do 6 pieces a year, you really need to have another means of one, getting your brand out there and being able to have lots of people enjoy your artwork, but then also to sustain as a working artist.
Now, I don't know if Ashby, you can answer this, but maybe not in your specialty, but intellectual property. How do you guys protect yourself from somebody just going on and...
All the artwork is copywritten, and we actually employ a trademark patent attorney whose sole job it is to keep track of that and also to track other people down. And actually, a couple years ago, we won a Supreme Court precedent by... we were able to bust a gallery that had a guy who was painting Thomas Arvid pieces and signing his name as Arvid. So it was enough pieces inside this gallery that it was a felony. So the FBI actually came in and took the guy out and confiscated all the pieces.
How did you even know that was happening?
Well, fortunately, there was a Arvid gallery down the street who said, look, I've got the real thing. How am I able to do business if there's this person? And the copies were not even that good. That's what's kind of sad, is you're like, could you have hired a better guy?
Like the Thomas Arvid affair.
Right. So once we heard about that, then, we were able to consult our attorney about it. And generally, for the most part, when you send a cease and desist letter, that's enough, because a lot of artists, unfortunately, just don't realize, hey, if this is not your original idea, you probably have a much better original idea. So pursue something that's your own, and that will bring you success. So when they try to copy, sometimes it's just like, oh gosh, okay, this is not the right path. But the international market has had a huge impact on us. A lot of the art expositions that I go to, half of what I do is kind of wear a ball cap, and that way people don't recognize me, and I go through to see if there's anyone copying the artwork.
Right.
And, a lot of the, international companies will project the artwork, so you can tell right away because everything's flipped and none of the spelling makes any sense on the bottle. So instead of saying Silver Oak, it's like Croissant. It doesn't make any sense. But so that's really helped, because you know, I would say 5 years ago, you know, it was a constant battle. Part of my job was to continuously do this. Now I see it maybe once or twice a year. So mm-hmm. it's had a big impact to stay vigilant and to copyright all the work.
It sounds like it could be a good reality TV show now. Like, I could just see the FBI storming into galleries, you know?
Well, you know what? It really was quite dramatic because the guy decided he was not coming out. So he like holed up and they're like, well, we're going to have to get the SWAT team now to come in.
Wow.
So yeah, it was on, you can look at the website. The video is
on the
website.
Video on the website.
It's in Wisconsin. So, you know, I don't know.
Oh,
I don't have stuff there.
That is amazing.
So Katie, do you have intellectual property issues or because you're
but
aggregating all this stuff?
Not
personally, but on the website because you're aggregating so much content.
Yeah. Well, Turner has a whole team of attorneys who go mm-hmm. after things like that. So, you know, it's never come up for me. The only thing is, you know, anyone taking our property. So I know the attorneys are probably, you know, looking over that kind of stuff all the time. The other thing too, on our side is more of kind of the flip side of, you know, making sure that people put things out there all the time online, you know, blogs, photos, and, you know, we can't just take them. And like, you know, if we want to quote somebody, how much can we quote them? And that gets back to that whole thing of linking back to folks and sending them traffic. And if you want to reference what they're doing, you can't just sort of swipe their whole blog, put it on your site,
and then
send
pretend
a link back.
It's yours, right?
Yeah, it's like, thanks for the article.
Look how smart I am.
I know. Right. I wrote this thing today. Now, you want to, we're very, you know, this, again, CNN is an HLN. It's just an amazing place to work. And there's teams of folks, of editors on the on-air side and on the digital side that you work with to sort of have these discussions of if there is, again, a mommy blogger out there who wrote a really great piece about raising our kids and you want to quote them, you know, how comfortable are we with sort of taking a quote and sending a link back to her or taking a paragraph or, you know, how do you attribute things like that? So I am less concerned about people taking our content, which, again, because we have a great team behind us, but also reinforcing to our staff, you know, that you know, in this sort of online world where people share things all the time, they tweet things all the time, they make photos up and then they put them out there, you know, what is ours and what is fair and what is anyone's to grab.
Right. But so, but is that, that's, that doesn't seem like it's impacting your day to day. It's just kind of the noise in the background.
Yeah. It's just something to think about. You know, right. You'll see things like a photo will get shared a million times on Facebook and, you know, we want to run a story about it. Well, do we own that photo? No. Is it right to the photographer for us to take that photo and put it on our site? Absolutely not. Do we approach them and talk to them and say we want to cover this and do you want to appear on our air? There was a story the other day. It was a photographer who had taken all these photos of a soldier and his now wife. It was their kind of love story told in photos and pictures of them together. And then he went off to Afghanistan and he was injured. He actually lost, I believe, all four of his limbs, came back to the U.S. She helped him rehabilitate. They got engaged and they got married. And their
wow.
whole love story was told these photos. And these pictures were like all over the place. I saw this. I'm like, this is such
right,
an HLN story. We've
story.
Got to cover this. So we can't swipe these photos. We're not just going to take them and run the site. It's not even good enough just to write a story about the photos that are out there. So we contacted the photographer and said, tell us your story. Tell us how you found this couple. Tell us what you know about this couple and, you know, kind of how did this all sort of unfold and how did you become the person who was able to chronicle this love story, this
right.
heroic journey and kind of tell us from your point of view, you know, how this all came together. So we did that, ran an interview with him and he gave us the okay to run a few of his photos on the site. And that story was our biggest story for about 2 days. It kept getting shared and shared and shared because, you know, for me, I feel comfortable because we're telling the story,
right.
We're telling it in a unique way, and we found the source who had a really interesting perspective on this couple's life together.
Right. Well, I think that that you're in a unique spot in that you're aggregating, but you also have the ability to create this original content, and you're getting the information from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Whereas some aggregated sites, they're just pulling links from wherever
yeah.
they find them.
It's the nice thing about, you know, launching. We launched just last year, and launching with this sort of bigger brand name behind us, there is a sort of element of trust, and that's a huge thing
for us. It's a responsibility.
Yeah, we
right.
have to live up to it every single day. So we might cover, you know, sort of crazier stories or celebrity stories, but, you know, when I tell you that every single story is held up to the same standards across CNN and HLN, you really wouldn't believe the checks and balances and the systems we have in place to make sure that we are asking every question, that we've gotten every side. You know, work really closely with Nancy Grace's team, and, you know, they've got this silly thing that goes on their blog every day called Mugshot of the Day. And it's like, today there's a guy who has like a squirrel in his pants. For some reason, you get arrested for that. I'm not sure why. Abby, I don't know. You could probably Ashby, you can kind of weigh in on that later. But there's, you know, there's that's sort of like a silly kind of one-off thing that we do every single day. But even that, you know, mugshots are fair use. So we get them from the police department. They put calls in to make sure if we're saying this is an allegation, has he been convicted of this? Right. So that is like a silly little like one-off thing that we do every single day. But, you know, make sure we have to make sure there's a vetting process behind that. Right. You can't just put out someone's mugshot and then not have, you know, made the calls. So yeah, there's a certain level of trust across CNN and HLN. And we have to sort of protect the brand, you know, that every single day with every URL that we put out there. And for us being a relatively new brand on the digital side, every single link, every single URL, every single page you go to on our site could be the first introduction that anyone has to hlntv.com. So we have to represent all of the brand and people sort of seeing, you know, kind of who we are and what our voice is and that they can trust us. This is a great place for fun stories and good links on every single page. So...
good stuff. Well, we're running out of time. I'd like to ask each of you before we go to share a piece of advice maybe for a young woman that's thinking about getting into your specific field. Why don't we start with you, Baggy?
Well, my best advice for young up-and-coming artists or women who are going into the art field is to really think about it as being, you know, starting your own business, to have a business plan that, you know, if you have art and you're talented, you know, it's great to think that somebody's going to come and snatch up your artwork, but really to have a thought out plan that you have, you know, figured out how are you going to manage supply and demand, you know, take a business class, learn about accounting,
right.
You know, understand all of those angles before you get involved in signing contracts or going with a publishing company or even before you start selling to a gallery.
Good stuff. Katie?
I guess my advice would be to kind of make really good contacts. That sounds super vague. But one thing that's very specific I always ask people to do is find the folks who have the job that you want to have in 5 years. And figure out the email address of wherever they work, firstname.lastname@company.com, and email them and just say, hi, I am so-and-so. I'm Ashby, I'm Maggie, I'm whoever. And I would like to, you know, your career is actually really interesting to me. It's really intriguing. I'd love to know how you did it. And I'm not talking about go to the top of the masthead, the CEO, the partner, the whoever. Like, look at like a mid-level person who has that job, again, in 3, 4, 5 years that you'd like to have. Reach out to them directly. And just say, you know, what path did you take and how did you get there? And would you mind like meeting for, can we talk on the phone for 5 minutes? Can we have a coffee? The more you start to make those connections, you know, the folks that I am friends with from New York who, you know, we were copy editors working 50-hour shift, right. Crazy shifts together, you know, all throughout the night. We were lower level editors together. They're now, you know, the editor of people.com,
right. Guess what?
The
now,
editor of Life and Style. Right. We were friends back. If somebody had emailed me then, said, please, like, tell me how you got there in your career, I would have definitely taken him up on that offer. And now we're all kind of together on a different level. And so I think kind of reaching out to people and kind of contacting them directly and, you know, flattery will get you everywhere.
I'm really surprised that you didn't say lie.
Oh, and lie. Now, who was that Yahoo exec that had to, like, resign because he had, like, had a little fib on his resume. So, no, I do not.
Market yourself, but don't lie.
Well, at least don't lie in print.
Yeah.
Be more clever. Yes. About this.
Lie creatively, cleverly.
Now, Ashby?
Just to kind of mirror something that Katie said, one of the things that we're focusing on in our women's initiative is to use your resources. Find a mentor. Reach out to somebody who's done what you want to do. Find a female equity partner in your firm and say, how did you do it? How did you manage to, you know,
right.
be where you are and have 4 kids before you were 35? How did you do all of these things? And so find a mentor and use your resources. They're out there. You just have to not be afraid of making that contact and going out on a limb and asking for help. And that's kind of the other focus of our initiative is women need to ask. Traditionally, men never seem to have a problem asking for what they want. And women, for whatever reason, because of social constructs or because of, you know, expectations that we think exist, we frequently just don't ask. And we need to ask. We need to ask for support. We need to ask for what we want. If we feel like we're being undercompensated, we need to ask why, and we need to ask for what we want. So that's, you know, my advice would be to the women out there, if you want to be somewhere, if you see somebody who's done what you want to do, ask. Just ask and right. find those resources and don't be afraid to use them.
Great advice.
Great advice. Well, thank you all for participating in our Women in Leadership special here at Results Matter Radio. This is Lee Cantor for Dana Barrett. We will see you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.